many of Lewis's best ideas are found in these books, you know, ideas that work their way into some of his more mainstream texts.
These books are a fine representation of faith-integrated thinking.
This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of the show. My guests today are Mark Neal and Jerry Root. Previously, they co-authored The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. So would you be surprised to learn they have teamed up again? They have, and it's new for 2020. The Neglected C.S. Lewis. That title may actually surprise you because Lewis is so well known. But keep listening to find out what Neal and Root mean. Welcome back to All About Jack, Mark and Jerry.
Thank you very much, William.
Thanks, William.
We're happy to be here. We like the way that you continue to do things that draw people who love Lewis together into sort of a round table where they can think about the big ideas of Lewis. So we're grateful to be on your program.
Well, thank you. Well, speaking of big ideas, there's a lot of big ideas in the book that you two have written. The title is The Neglected C.S. Lewis, and while the subtitle provides some insight into the meaning, first say what the subtitle is and then give a brief explanation about what it means.
Well, the subtitle is Exploring the Riches of His Most Overlooked Books. And so, you know, as Jerry and I were talking, we came up with the idea of this book kind of in thinking about how people read Lewis. So many people are very familiar with his more theological or apologetic works or even his fiction. But even people that know Lewis very well tend to not know this literature, this body of literature that we're writing about, or not know it very well.
Or avoid it.
Or avoid it altogether, because it is and can be very difficult at times. The writing is just complex and abstruse, and there's a lot of big ideas in there to grapple with, so people tend to avoid it. So what we wanted to do for Lewis is what Lewis himself did for other authors. He engaged in what he called rehabilitation, which is bringing back to the mainstream authors and literary genres or periods that had been neglected. And so we decided we wanted to do the same thing for Lewis, to dust off some of these older works that maybe people didn't know about as well, or hadn't read, or had some familiarity with, but just hadn't got around to reading them, or had avoided them, as we mentioned. So again, engaging in rehabilitation to bring these works forward and to help people engage with many of the big ideas that are found there. In fact, we think that many of Lewis's best ideas are found in these books, you know, ideas that work their way into some of his more mainstream texts.
One of the books that we didn't cover, but we list in the back of our book, maybe we'll attend to it another time if we do a sequel to this one, is the preface to Paradise Lost. You can read Paradise Lost and then go back and read Lewis. Or you could read a preface to Paradise Lost and it opens the gate to go into Paradise Lost. Either way, you can benefit from these books, whether you've read. Some people are intimidated because they don't feel like they have the literary background to read what Lewis is talking about. And I don't think you have to be. I think you could read these books then as literary introduction. And I think there's a whole wide world open for people if they explore the neglected C.S. Lewis.
Well, now, the meat of the book is the 8 chapters devoted to the titles from Lewis that are often overlooked, and then we'll talk later about the appendix that you made reference to. But let's consider and have each of you share one of the chapters that you primarily wrote, and whether it be maybe a favorite that's all-time or recent or that just really stands out that you always like to make sure people are aware of from Lewis.
Sure. Well, I'll go first. My pick would be The Discarded Image. And The Discarded Image is really a guidebook that Lewis wrote as a sort of, you know, introduction to the medieval worldview and cosmology. And it's a fascinating book. Lewis himself loved the medieval model. He found it imaginatively compelling. And in reading through that book, it's interesting because what you'll find is if you read The Discarded Image and really sort of digest its contents, and then you go back and you read The Chronicles of Narnia or the Ransom Trilogy you'll find that those readings of those works of fiction have been greatly enriched by understanding this medieval cosmology, because Lewis is weaving these ideas from the medieval worldview into these works. And so it just provides a great level of richness to that reading experience.
He also calls it the discarded image as a reminder that every worldview will eventually become a discarded image. It may capture something of a moment, but it doesn't capture anything with permanence. So consequently, it's going to have to give away to more robust understandings. So the whole book is written with humility. It's also written with insight. Plus, you don't want to read a medieval book and project on a 21st century values. You need to understand it out of its context. And that discarded image was a series of lectures, grew out of a series of lectures Lewis gave at Oxford University for 29 years.
Yeah.
This is hugely influential on Lewis. Mark wrote that chapter on the discarded image and did a brilliant job with it. I couldn't reduce it, William, to just one book. I'm going to talk briefly, very briefly, about four, and I'm going to say why they're so important, why people need to read them. The first one's The Personal Heresy, where he's engaged in an academic debate with E.M.W. Tilliard of Jesus College, Cambridge, over how much you need to know of the personality of an author in order to understand his work. And while Lewis and Tilliard disagreed, in this age of polarization, it's wonderful to have a great, robust academic debate where the parties produce light and not heat. And I think anybody who sees the difficulty of an age of polarization would benefit from that book. Another one is his Oxford History of English Literature in the 16th Century, excluding drama. From the time he signed the contract till the book came out on the shelves, it was about 18 years. He called it his Oh Hell volume, Oxford History of English Literature, because he did so much work on it. But he said of the other works he was working on during that time, they were his twiddly bits. This was his magnum opus. Well, what were the twiddly bits at? Mere Christianity, his science trilogy, his Narnia books, The Discarded Image, Screwtape Letters, Problem of Pain, his other miracles, and so on. So when we talk about this book, Lewis thought this was so important, he compared everything else with the twiddly bits. Well, the deal is that's the century of the Reformation. To write that book on 16th century literature, he read every book written in the 16th century. He read every book translated into English in the original language it was written, Old French, Italian, Latin, and in translation, so he could make judgments on the translations that would be fair-minded. It was the century of the Reformation. Anybody who wants to study the Reformation should study this book. Lewis is the only guy I know that read thoroughly both sides of the argument, and he's more nuanced in his judgments. He said the Catholics thought that the Protestants were antinomian. The Protestants thought the Catholics were Pelagian. He said both of them were wrong. Certainly you could find the antinomian and you could find the Pelagian on the other side, but that's if you're bottom fishing, looking for the worst examples on the other side. Lewis doesn't do that. He reads honestly, he reads magnanimously, he doesn't project or overjudge. Wonderful book to read in light of that. And another one's The Allegory of Love. And this, basically, he is looking at the tracing the development of the love allegory till it gets to its zenith in Christian marriage in Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen. In an age where marriage is under assault in our country and under assault in our world, what could be better than to see this broad sweep of this medieval interest in love and how it's expressed and how it finds its zenith of expression in Christian marriage? I think it's a wonderful book. Anyway, that's three, but I'll just leave it there.
Okay. Well, now talk some more about how you guys decided to team up for this project. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the other book, but in terms of, you can make a passing reference to it, of course, but why was this such an idea that you guys both embraced?
Well, you know, we've been longtime friends. So that's a piece of it. But we also published a previous book together called The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. So it seemed natural to just go on from there and write some additional things on Lewis. And really, no one, I don't think, has done a volume quite like this to kind of resurrect these old works. So it was unique. So we thought it would be a great idea.
Even in light of that, too, Mark's the better writer. He had written several journal articles before we collaborated and so on. He had not done a book yet on Lewis. But the thing is, I think he's a better writer. And I wanted in the first collaboration to be involved with him. The second one was more hatched by him. It was more his idea. But the thing is, though, we found we worked well together, and we found we wanted to explore places where we're not just repeating the same old with Lewis. It seems like every time there's a new book that comes out, that book has already been written before, 20 times before. So we want to explore new areas and so on. So that's a huge part of it, and we're good friends.
Well, now the next question here, I don't know what you're going to do with Jerry here, but I'm sure you can add some comments. But the way I've got it written is, considering the other remaining books that hasn't been elaborated upon, what's one that maybe most people might consider the most optional? Either you've heard it or, you know, it's kind of it's something that might be pretty typical for people to say they want to avoid. But that of the remaining books you haven't talked about, can speak to one that you say, don't skip this, it's important because of whatever reason.
I'll let Mark answer one of the books in just a moment, but I'll say something. I'll say one book in just a moment.
But I want to say something about it.
I want to say something else first that's not related to that. I think a lot of people are intimidated by Lewis, and they're intimidated by his academic side, and I don't think you should be. Lewis opens more than wardrobe doors. If you trusted him taking you into Narnia and you benefited by that, if you trusted him when he exposed your soul as he took you to the Screwtape Letters, trust him here too. And I think you can look at these books and discover a wider, wider world. And I don't think you can understand Lewis as well as you might if you fail to grasp his love of the faith-integrated approach to the liberal arts, which comes out strong. I like telling people about Jesus. I think the greatest news in the world is that God loves us, and we're all messed up, and he forgives us, and he's willing to enter into our world as he did in the incarnate Christ, but also enter into our hearts through the Holy Spirit and bring order out of the chaos. Well, Lewis said most of his books were evangelistic. Well, how did he mean that when he writes all these literary critical works? Well, later he said that we don't need more books by Christians about Christianity. We need more books by Christians on other subjects with their Christianity late. These books are a fine representation of, again, faith-integrated thinking. And I think if you aren't trying to develop faith-integrated thinking, you'll probably become what one of his students, Harry Beaumeyer, said in his book, The Christian Mind, a secular Christian. You have a compartment for your family life, a compartment for your vocation, a compartment for your hobbies, a compartment for economics, a compartment for politics, a compartment for this and that. And then finally you become a Christian, you just add another compartment. It's just a segment of something that's out there. But it's not faith integrated. Instead of having God, Lord of all, and everything relates to him, Lewis will expand your thinking as far as becoming an accomplished thinking Christian as you learn the art. When you were a kid in first grade, you were learning how to write, and your teacher gave you all the alphabet on a piece of paper, and the first letter was filled in all the way, and you copied it. The next one was dotted. The next two or three were dotted, and you copied them. And finally, you could go on and write your own. Well, look at this as learning how to write, learning how to understand how to think in Lewis, reading Lewis and seeing how he does it, and then going from there. G.K. Chesterton once said, "The world will never starve for want of wonders, only for want of wonder." Allow yourself to enter into the wonder of this literature. So that's what I would say, and it's about all of them more than about one of them. And then Mark has one he wants to talk about.
Well, I would also say, just addressing the level of difficulty that is perceived in reading these books, you know, if you're not willing to undergo some sort of rigor in reading this books, you're probably not willing to grow. So I would just say, you know, any growth comes with a certain amount of disequilibrium. And you know, as Jerry, if you looked at our copies of these books, you know, they're laboriously marked up, and we engage in a conversation with the text, and we do rereading. And so it's slow and painstaking, but these books really do, if you put the time into study, yield up these sorts of treasures. But I was going to mention too, like, just, you know, you had asked about one book that people might overlook. You know, Studies in Words is one of those pretty, you know, opaque books. It's just a slog almost to read through. You know, he looks at the word histories of 7 or 8 different words, and he just goes into such depth and looking at all the sort of historical meanings and how they've changed over time. He looks at sort of principles of meaning change, and it's a fabulous book once you get into it, but, you know, it's very easy to see how people would be deterred by it. But Lewis writes at the beginning of that book that he writes the book in order that people might be able to read old literature more accurately. And I think he writes many of his books for that reason. You know, The Discarded Image, Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature. There's a whole slew of these books that he writes as intros and guides to those different periods, so that when people are reading those works of literature, they're reading them more accurately as they were written by the authors of the time, and not bringing their contemporary worldviews to bear on those texts and so misreading.
I wanted to mention one more too, William. Mm-hmm. We have in there The Arthurian Torso. Most people won't even have heard of it. C.S. Lewis's dear friend and fellow inkling Charles Williams had written a bunch of poetry on the Arthurian myth or the Arthurian legend. And he read these to Lewis, and he talked with Lewis about them. But Williams died prematurely. He had, like, I think, a gallbladder operation. It was right at the end of World War II. And consequently, he died before the world really got to see these things. I think he had published one of the volumes of poems before. But Lewis felt an obligation to his dear friend to do literary critical work on the Arthurian the Arthurian poems. But what Lewis does at the beginning of the section on the Arthurian Torso, he gives a broad sweeping description of Charles Williams' theology. Now, J.I. Packer, this great evangelical theologian, just died about a week and a half ago maybe. And I had many conversations with Packer about Lewis and so on. His favorite of the inklings was Charles Williams. And he felt he was the most theologically imaginative. And it is Lewis who gives that side of Williams expression. Williams writes about it himself in most of his books, The Descent of the Dove, He Came Down from Heaven, even the figure of Beatrice. You get these things. But Lewis is a great guide to Williams' impressive theological imagination and insight. So the Arthurian Torso will give you that world.
Okay, yeah, fascinating. Well, now, many of the listeners will know each of you, but there are those that aren't as familiar with either of you. So let's pause for a moment and have each of you give some of your professional background, especially as it relates to Lewis.
Well, I should probably go first, because when Jerry gives his background relating to Lewis, it's going to make me look really bad. So, but anyway, I have been studying and writing and speaking on Lewis for about 10 years. I've published 2 books with Jerry on Lewis. I've taught and lectured both nationally and internationally on Lewis, written a number of articles, and continue to write on Lewis. And my day job is VP of digital marketing for a marketing firm here in the area.
If you want to write a book and you want it to go well, write it with a marketer. It always helps. Mark the marketer. That's a good thing. My own background, I got onto Lewis when I was in college. I was a brand new Christian. And I think in some senses he became a spiritual guide for me. But I've been studying him for 50 years. I've been teaching college and graduate courses on him for 40 years continuously. I wrote my master's thesis on Lewis. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Lewis. Steve Beebe, who listens to your podcast, he was one of my supervisors. He was a brilliant man and a very hopeful, hope-giving supervisor. But I did my doctorate with him and with Basil Mitchell, who was the vice president of the Oxford Socratic Club, became the president of Socratic Club when Lewis went to Cambridge. I've lectured on him in 78 universities in 18 different countries. I have 7 books on Lewis, and as well as many articles, academic papers presented at theology conferences and so on. But I still can't write as well as Mark writes. His ability to write so well intrigues me, and therefore I hope this isn't our last collaboration. I would like to do more with him, but I think eventually I'll be the ball and chain around his ankle and he'll want to sprint out beyond
the albatross.
Yeah. That's some background.
Okay. Well, now we've already referenced other book that you guys have done, and there's actually a podcast I originally caught up with you, Jerry, and then later Mark separately. So it's good to have you both together for this interview. But I'll have a link in the show notes for each of those interviews. But go ahead, either of you or both of you, give a summary of the other book, The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis, that you've done together.
Sure. And, you know, this is, Jerry came up with this idea, so credit where credit's due. You know, and you can maybe tell a little bit more about how you found these. But as he was reading through the literature, he just noticed that Lewis would reference the imagination in different ways. So, for instance, he would talk about the penetrating imagination or the satisfied imagination or the controlled imagination. And as Jerry was looking and I was looking, we ended up discovering about 30 or more of these types of imagination or manifestations of the imagination that Lewis specifically called out. And so what we did in the book is we devoted 12 chapters to 12 different manifestations of the imagination as identified by Lewis. And each of the 12, not each of the 12 chapters, but the 12 chapters in whole, cover many of his literary genres and a number of different works. And so in each chapter, we look at different manifestations of the imagination. For example, the satisfied imagination Lewis talks about in The Discarded Image. The satisfied imagination seeks to find pleasure in the mundane such that it brings the mind back to the order, the source of order in pleasure, which is God. The controlled imagination is projective. So all types of imagination are not beneficial. There are certainly harmful ones as well, and we cover some of those in the book. But I think most importantly, in writing the book on the imagination, we wanted to correct maybe an error in the way people think about the imagination. I think the imagination can often be marginalized by people who think it's just make-believe, right? And I think in the book, we wanted to make the case that imagination is actually a way to get truth about reality in a way that you can't through reason alone. You know, for example, if we think about God is infinite. We as humans are finite. And so, the word definition means of the finite. So God breaks that category of definition. He's completely outside of it. So how do we get to him? How do we access him? How do we understand him? Well, Jesus told parables about the kingdom of heaven. And what are parables? They're stories. They're ways to use the imagination. They're metaphors. They're things that approximate the reality. They're not the reality itself, but they get us close. They get us to an understanding. And so, again, just bringing home this idea that the imagination is actually really important. And Lewis himself, wrestled with this in his pre-conversion years. He said the two hemispheres of my mind were in sharp contrast, And so he always had this struggle between reason and imagination. And the imagination was the more appealing of the two, but then he would just believe that there wasn't any reality to it. But then in reality, the reality of the war and so forth that he was involved in, he just found utterly meaningless. And so he had this division in his mind that was ultimately reconciled when he became a believer.
It was in many ways a quest for meaning for him and understanding as well. So even the scientist begins their scientific work with imaginative exercise. They cast out a hypothesis. It's not the thing itself. It's an imaginative endeavor. Then they test it to see if it's accurate or not, if what they imagined was so. If they discover something, then they immediately try to depict it, but they use models, which are not the thing itself. They're just depictions of this thing that they've discovered. So we find we use the imagination, but there's no growth of the mind. There's no moving outside of our present understanding if we don't grasp with the imagination and then develop further. The imagination is not the only thing. It's an important thread in the fabric of how we understand things. We don't see everything with our eyes or feel everything with our hands, our fingers. It's not merely an empirical, an empirically understood world. There are some things that we can see with the eyes of the heart, or we see with the eyes of the imagination. And we end up catching the aroma of things as a result of the uses of the imagination.
Yeah, and again, for the listener, you can find links in the show notes to the other interviews about that book, as well as a direct link to be able to get a copy of The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. I highly recommend it. Well, returning then to The Neglected C.S. Lewis, which came out here in 2020, the time that we're recording in late July, you guys have an appendix where you've mentioned it already, but there are 7 additional titles. Briefly comment on what's covered, and is this basically maybe groundwork for an eventual book, or what can people glean from these 7 additional titles?
Well, we can kind of split up what's here. I'll give you just kind of the gist of a couple of them, and maybe Jerry can talk to him. But yeah, we have talked about an additional volume as well, but haven't come to any conclusion as to whether that'll happen. But in the appendix, there are 7 additional neglected titles. The first is The Preface to Paradise Lost, which of course is another of Lewis's guidebooks, so that we might read that poem more accurately. The book Image and Imagination, which collects all of Lewis's book reviews and so forth.
Most of the essays, interestingly enough, in Image and Imagination have been published before. Not all of them, but most of them, in other words.
We look at Of Other Worlds and Rehabilitations, Spencer's Images of Life, Studies of Medieval and Renaissance Literature, which is very similar to what you'll find in The Discarded Image. And there's additional work in there as well. And then they asked for a paper.
So the other thing too, the Spencer's Images of Life is interesting. These were lectures he gave, and he died before he finished that book. So Alistair Fowler, who was one of his students, actually finished the book. But you can see some of the lecture notes, and then you read what Fowler wrote. It's basically Lewis. It's pretty much Lewis. But Spencer's an important author to Lewis. English literature in the 16th century, he classifies Edmund Spencer as one of the golden authors of that period. And if you look at the Allegory of Love, the book that established Lewis's literary reputation, the whole zenith of his development on Allegory of Love is Spencer's Image of Marriage in The Faerie Queen. Lewis loved The Faerie Queen. And then another one, too, is I'd comment on A Preface to Paradise Lost. Lewis was a great Milton fan. And this debate that he had with E.M.W. Tilliard in The Personal Heresy, Tilliard had written a book on Milton. So this is, in some ways, Lewis's response to that book. And he's trying to do literary criticism of Milton. And it's interesting to me, too, because he explores even the theology of that book and the influence of Augustine on Milton and so on. Another one, too, I would want to make just a comment on quickly, Of Other Worlds. If you like his Narnia books and if you like the science books, science fiction books, you need to read Of Other Worlds, because he's got essays on what he's trying to do with his fiction. He's got essays on what he's trying to do with his science fiction, and it's a wonderful book. Three Ways of Writing for Children is almost as an important essay as is Tolkien's essay on fairy stories. I don't think it's quite as important as Tolkien, but it's up there. It's with it. And Rehabilitations has some of the lectures he gave at Oxford University when he was a young professor in the 1930s. And you'll see these ideas that will develop much further in Lewis in those essays. And what you begin to see is that there's a strong skeletal structure to Lewis that seems to follow him all of his years, even though he fleshes it out more robustly as time passes. So I think that we didn't feel that it would be right to produce this book without also giving some of those other books that we think people should not neglect as well.
Well, here's a spontaneous question. One of the books from Lewis, it's not literary criticism, but is often overlooked, is Boxen. Can you comment on that as to why it wasn't considered or why it could be considered?
Well, it is neglected, I think. Most people don't even know it exists. And I don't know if it's even in print now. But the thing is, though, it's his Juvenalia. It's not his literary criticism. And we set the limitations for ourselves for this book. that we would work with his literary critical work. So as a matter of fact, I would say too, I've read it, Box, and it's interesting that a little child could write this book, but it's about as valuable as the book written by a very precocious child. But it's still not what I would say is the zenith of Lewis's thought.
Yeah, and you know, if we were going to go the whole way and write about everything he had neglected, we would probably include, you know, Lewis's early, well, it's his first published work, Spirits in Bondage, a volume of poetry. Also something like Dimer. I don't know, is there anything else you can think of?
Well, the thing is, though, about Dimer, I've got a book coming out on Dimer.
Right, so it's not going to be quite as neglected.
Yeah. It'll be out in October, so it won't be quite as neglected, but we're waiting for Mark to do the book on the literary criticism of Spirits in Bondage. There are some important seminal thoughts in Spirits in Bondage that come out in great play in his other books.
Okay, well, interesting. Yeah, well, we'll definitely have you back on when it's closer to the book for Dimer to come out that you've done. Now, let's go ahead and wrap up here, do that a final summary here. Say if you caught someone on an elevator, they're asking you about why should I get a copy of the neglected C.S. Lewis, what would be that summary pitch of why they would want to not neglect your book, The Neglected C.S. Lewis?
Well, I think I'm going to play with this question a little bit. So the most harsh criticism Lewis ever wrote was his literary critical work on Rudyard Kipling. He thought Kipling was a technologically perfect poet. He thought he crossed every T right, dotted every I right, got his meter, rhyme scheme, everything was right. But he said he was the poet of the inner ring. And if you know Lewis, and if you know the nice and that hideous strength, you know what the inner ring is. And if you've read his essay, The Inner Ring, you know. It's horrible criticism. Lewis gives no ad hominems when he critiques somebody, but this was pretty sharp criticism. Nevertheless, Kipling wrote a poem called The English Flag, and it begins, "Who knows England who only England knows?" And I would say, who knows Lewis who only knows his apologetic works? Or who knows Lewis who only knows his Narnia books? Or who knows Lewis who only knows Screwtape Letters? I don't think you're going to know Lewis as holistically as one ought if you don't know these books. And therefore, you should read The Neglected Lewis to be a gateway into these great books that Lewis refers to. And those books that Lewis wrote are gateways into other literature as well. Do you want anything, Mark?
No, that's a great summary.
Well, again, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to have Mark and Jerry here on All About Jack. Thanks, guys, for being a part.
Thanks, William. We appreciate it.
Yeah, we're grateful. Thanks for your friendship over the years, too.
Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host, and you've been listening to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a short YouTube channel entitled 90 Seconds to Knowing C.S. Lewis. There's a link to it in the show notes. Today, my guests were Mark Neal and Jerry Root, author of The Neglected C.S. Lewis, exploring the riches of his most overlooked books. You'll find a direct link to it in the show notes, as well as two links to my other interviews with Mark and Jerry, as well as Mark's website. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled PODBEAN. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. See the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis Most are not by him. Some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.